The headlines: a rights group denounces Israel's an apartheid regime that enforces Jewish supremacy in the occupied Palestinian territories. Scientists at the World Health Organization warn that mass vaccinations will not bring about herd immunity to the coronavirus this year. And a third member of U.S. President Donald Trump's cabinet resigns in reaction to last week's breach of the Capitol by supporters of the president. Our top story for this half hour. An Israeli rights group says Israel is an apartheid regime that enforces Jewish supremacy in the occupied Palestinian territories. B'Tselem says Israel has created a system over all the territory in which Jewish citizens have full rights. That's why the rights group says Palestinians are divided into tiers with various levels of rights, but always below Jewish people. B'Tselem says Israel has effective control on the Gaza Strip, which the regime blockades, and in the West Bank, Palestinians live in disconnected enclaves under rigid military rule and without political rights. B'Tselem is a non-profit organization that documents human rights violations in the Israeli-occupied territories. Mona Kandil says Israel's treats Palestinians as if they are the minority and that they are not the real owners of the land.
It's the first time that B'Tselem is accusing Israel of apartheid. The report issued by B'Tselem saying that what Israel is doing on ground, it's not democracy and occupation, as it claims that the Israeli authorities occupy the West Bank, besiege the Gaza Strip and a part of Jerusalem. Unquote. On ground, what's going on is apartheid between river and the sea. Because at the time the Israelis are occupying the West Bank, we are speaking about, let's say, 62% of the West Bank, where settlements are being built on a private Palestinian lands and on mountains, on hills. Jews are living there. They are having their full rights. Everything they want, they receive. At the same time, Palestinians, who are the real owners of the land, they are not receiving their rights. They are being arrested, shot, killed. Every day, Israeli forces storm the Palestinian lands in the occupied West Bank and arrest people. They confiscate their lands in order to annex it to the settlement. So they continue to treat the Palestinians as they are minority and that they are not the real owners of the land.
COVID-19 infections in the Gaza Strip have jumped to over 45,000 cases. This comes as the tiny enclave is struggling with the Israeli blockade that continues to undermine its efforts to combat the deadly pandemic. Asher Shannon has more of this report.
Coronavirus infections among the general population are still rising in the blockaded Gaza Strip. The number of infections has risen to over 45,000, mostly since August of last year. Hospitals in Gaza continue to run low on intensive care units and ventilators, as well as medicines and equipment. The Israeli blockade and multiple wars since 2007 have had a devastating impact on Gaza's health sector.
The international community must exert real pressure on Israel to end its illegal blockade of Gaza and allow local authorities to combat the coronavirus pandemic. The international community must also provide badly needed medical aid to the overwhelmed health sector in Gaza, which is already in a bad shape and struggling to fight the coronavirus.
The pandemic has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the blockaded Gaza Strip, threatening the socioeconomic welfare of people in Gaza as much as their health.
People here are terrified by the rapid spread of coronavirus infections. Our hospital lack of vital equipment and medicines, and our health system has been battered by the Israel blockade.
The economy has been hit hard by the pandemic, and people are afraid and hardly have any income. Nowadays, it is very hard to maintain a business because of the tight restrictions.
Local authorities in the tiny enclave have been desperately fighting to prevent the spread of COVID-19. They currently impose lockdowns from 8 p.m. until 7 a.m. and a complete curfew on Fridays and Saturdays.
The emergency measures, including lockdowns, will continue in order to fight the spread of the virus. We call on everyone to stay at home during the lockdowns and abide by safety measures.
Human rights groups have repeatedly warned of the catastrophic implications of coronavirus spread in the Gaza Strip.
Experts say Israel's inhumane practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians, making it extremely difficult to fight the pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Well, the coronavirus pandemic continues to wreak havoc across the U.S. as the country has reported more than 22,000 fatalities for the second consecutive week. Data suggests that an average, the virus claimed over 3,200 lives per day in the world's worst-hit country last week. New confirmed cases also hit a weekly high there. Cumulatively, over 375,000 Americans have lost their lives, and more than 22.5 million others have tested positive since the outbreak of COVID-19. The vaccine rollout that began in the country last month has also hit snag amid reports of slow vaccinations. Less than a third of about 25.5 million doses attributed could be administered so far. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization warned that herd immunity would not be achieved this year despite coronavirus vaccines.
Even as vaccines start protecting the most vulnerable, we're not going to achieve any levels of population immunity or herd immunity in 2021. And even if it happens in a couple of pockets in a few countries, it's not going to protect people across the world.
The chief WHO scientist urged the need to continue taking public health and social measures aimed at halting transmission for the rest of this year. Meanwhile, Brazil, which is the world's second worst-hit country in terms of deaths, reported nearly 500 new fatalities, taking the tally to over 203,000. New cases there also rose by nearly 26,000 to more than 8.1 million. American and Brazilian presidents have faced harsh criticism for their lackluster response to the pandemic. Japan says it's isolating and analyzing a new strain of the coronavirus that was detected there at the weekend. The new variant was detected in four passengers who had arrived from Brazil. The Japanese Health Ministry says there is yet no evidence to show whether the new strain is more dangerous or transmissible. But it says the new variant holds similarities to those recently discovered in the UK and South Africa. The detection comes amid Japan's struggle to contain the pandemic. The country has declared a state of emergency in several western regions to battle the virus. Our correspondent Albert Siegel joins us now from the Japanese capital, Tokyo, with more details on the new strain found in Japan. Albert, talk to us more about what's going on there, also about further measures for lockdowns across Japan.
Well, that strain that came from Brazil that seems to be a little unique, that's one thing, but they just detected yesterday the UK strain did make it into Japan. Apparently, there was this individual that came to Japan from the UK that broke his quarantine requirements and held a dinner party with 10 people, infecting half of them. It's not known if it's infected beyond that, but the UK strain itself is in Japan, though it isn't widespread. There is a state of emergency, but it's not anywhere near as robust as the one from last year. And as such, a lot of businesses and individuals, frankly, are ignoring it. This last week was the first weekend that the state of emergency was in place. People have been going out. The estimate is the people going out is about 3.5 times higher than it was last year. Now, people are indeed concerned, and numbers are rising. Actually, the numbers are much higher now than they were last year, but the state of emergency is quite lower. The problem is that the government is trying very hard to balance the economy with the health measures, but it's just not doing a particularly effective job.
Let's talk about the economy a little bit, Albert. How has the lockdowns and the outbreak over the past year affected the economy in Japan?
Overall, the economy is still quite strong, but many smaller businesses have gone bankrupt. There is a huge financial strain on individuals, but for the most part, Japan economically is doing better than most other countries, mainly because Japan has actually had a better, I guess you could say, reaction to measures containing the virus. People generally do wear masks, and they are trying to social distance here. And Japan is culturally, it's not one of these groups of, one of these countries where people are very touchy-feely. There's no, you know, it's not customary to hug and kiss each other hello here. So people generally don't have close contact, which is probably why the virus hasn't become as widespread and why the economy itself is actually still doing quite well.
All right, thanks a lot, Albert Siegel, joining us from Tokyo. Indonesian divers resume search for the black boxes of an airliner that crashed into the sea with 62 people on board Saturday. Divers are combing through the wreckage off the capital Jakarta to find the devices. Authorities say they now have the approximate location of the black boxes after picking their signals. But strong currents and poor weather are a challenge. The flight data recorders are key to discovering why the Sriwijaya Air's Boeing 737 crashed. Its crew had reported no emergency or technical problems. 10 children have been among the passengers. Divers have so far found a number of bodies, but only one has been identified. A wave of resignations is sweeping through the U.S. administration following the siege of the Capitol building by pro-Donald Trump protesters. Acting Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf has said he's stepping down. He's the third cabinet official to quit his job in the aftermath of the attack. That comes amid a growing list of resignations by White House aides. In the meantime, counterterrorism prosecutors have opened probes into Wednesday's storming of the Congress building. The raid claimed at least six lives, including two police officers. Federal authorities have made dozens of arrests since several charges, that is, including domestic terrorism. The FBI has also warned law enforcement forces of more armed protests being planned for Washington, D.C. and 50 U.S. capital cities ahead of President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration scheduled for January the 20th. Former CIA counterterrorism officer John Kiriakou says supporters of U.S. President Donald Trump are still planning a coup.
What we're looking at here is a very well coordinated 50-state uprising. I wrote an article today, an op-ed today, calling this a coup. And the reason why I call it a coup, or at least a coup attempt, is that any intelligence analyst from any other country, when looking at the facts, would also call it a coup attempt. This is, we've had a democratically held election. The challenger won. The incumbent refused to accept the fact that he had lost. He called his supporters out. Those supporters converged on Washington with Molotov cocktails and weapons and handcuffs in order to arrest the Speaker of the House and the Senate Minority Leader. What else can you call it but a coup? Well, it didn't work last Wednesday. And so what these same people are doing is they're organizing similar uprisings in all 50 states, at all 50 state capitals, and challenging all 50 governors. If that isn't a coup attempt, I don't know what is. Now, one of the things that I think the FBI is just now starting to focus on is the fact that many of these people who are supporting an uprising are people who are current members of the military, they are current members of the police, they are current government employees in organizations like the FBI or the Department of Homeland Security or the Department of Defense. Those are the people that we need to be worried about because they are working against constitutionalism from the inside. And that's the most dangerous.
A group of U.S. House Republicans plan to introduce a censure resolution against President Donald Trump over his supporters' attack on the Capitol last week. Republican Tom Reed says the resolution will be introduced on Tuesday as an alternative to impeachment of Trump. But House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has called a censure measure the abdication of lawmakers' responsibility. The Democratic-led House has given President Trump one last chance on Tuesday to leave office or face an impeachment. The chamber plans to vote as soon as Wednesday on the articles of impeachment if Trump refuses to quit. The U.S. president is accused of inciting the violence on the Capitol as he kept refusing to concede defeat in the November presidential election.
The Democratic-controlled U.S. House of Representatives is expected to consider launch an impeachment process against the U.S. president on Wednesday. The Democratic lawmakers say they will move ahead with the measure if Vice President Mike Pence refuses to invoke the 25th Amendment, an article that would immediately unseat the president if he is deemed unfit for office.
That's going to be very difficult to achieve, one, because I don't think Vice President Pence is inclined to do so, probably viewing it as political suicide for his future in case he wants to run for president in the future. So I don't think that one's likely. In the context of impeachment, it is a political process. And right now, I think the will is there by the Democratic Party, and it seems like even some Republicans may be interested.
So far, we've seen an unwillingness of Pence, in particular, to move forward with the 25th Amendment, and Trump, of course, is not taking responsibility or taking it upon himself to resign, as he has been called upon to do. So I'm not surprised that impeachment is likely to be the result.
Democrats and a few Republican lawmakers are calling for Trump's removal from office, citing his conduct and rhetoric. Experts say the lack of bipartisan balance in the calls, however, can put U.S. national security at risk.
I think there's certainly a risk of something atrocious happening. I hope, hearing that Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker of the House, has been in contact with Pentagon officials, there may be some checks, but it does reveal somewhat of a danger in our process in terms of how powerful the executive is, and maybe we should think about that in the future.
The longer he remains in office, he still has access to all kinds of classified information and security codes. He has been isolating himself, which elevates the level of uncertainty about his actions in the coming days and weeks. I think there's definitely reason to be concerned about our overall security.
Last week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi underlined the urgency to remove Trump by speaking with Pentagon officials about safeguards of the president's access to the nuclear codes in the last days of his presidency. To make matters worse for Trump, the U.S. Department of Justice hasn't ruled out filing charges of insurrection, sedition, and attempted coup against him. Reporting from Miami, Rodney Curvello.
The EU foreign policy, she says, the 27-member bloc supports the return of the United States to the Iran nuclear deal once President-elect Joe Biden enters the Oval Office. In a statement, Borrell claimed the EU upheld its commitments under the deal, including sanctions lifting after the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the agreement in 2018. Tehran has repeatedly slammed the European signatories for not fulfilling their commitments. Iran started to scale back its commitments under the deal and recently started enriching uranium to the 20% purity level. Meanwhile, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency warned that Iran's higher enrichment of uranium means there are, quote, weeks left to salvage the agreement. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites.
listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, we're with you with another episode of this series. If you remember, in the previous episode we discussed Imam Khomeini's outstanding characteristics, namely his refraining from being introduced as a marja or a source of emulation by religious scholars as well as his students. And today we shall continue with the same discussion. Please stay with us. Famous tradition in seminaries was that a cleric who accepted to lead the prayer for the deceased source of emulation would be introduced as the next source of emulation. In other words, people would pay attention as to who was going to stand as the leader of the prayer for the former source of emulation. Then they would accept him as a substitute. But Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, in order not to be introduced as a source of emulation, took part only in funeral procession of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi and left the ceremony so that another cleric held the prayer. Ayatollah Muhammad Mahdi Rabbani Amlashi said in this regard, "When Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi passed away, all people wanted to see who would be the next source of emulation. We, the students of Imam Khomeini, had decided to glorify him at the funeral procession of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi to imply that the majority of the seminary students were advocates of him being a source of emulation. Thus, we were seeking to gather around him wherever he went during the ceremony and express our obedience and love to the Imam with reciting salawat. This way, we wanted to introduce him to the people, but we couldn't find him after a lot of searching." Imam Khomeini said later on, "I didn't come to the funeral procession of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi not because my health was so poor, but my refusal was because I realized that participation in the funeral had consequences and there would be raised issues in the ceremony. So I decided not to go there. Anyone who likes me, let that liking be in his heart. Let no one take a single step for me to become a chief. Another tradition for introducing a source of emulation in the seminaries was to hold mourning ceremonies for the deceased source of emulation. However, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, refused to do this as well. The Imam's younger son, late Haj Ahmad Agha Khomeini, said, "In summers, the Imam used to come to Imam Zadeh Qasim in Tehran with his family. After the passing away of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi, some of the ulama or religious scholars came to Imam Khomeini from Qom and insisted that he had to hold mourning ceremony. But the Imam said, 'I will neither hold the ceremony nor will I take part in it, because these things mean to raise the issue of a source of emulation.' I remember that even Mr. Eshraqi, the Imam's son-in-law, came and said the same thing to him, but the Imam did not accept." Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, had emphatically told his students not to mention his name in the gatherings and circles. Late Ayatollah Abul Qasim Khazali mentions a memory and anecdote in this regard. After the passing away of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi, people flocked to Qom from everywhere in Iran to mark him. The night that I was supposed to deliver a speech, I came to the late Imam Khomeini and asked him to tell me something. He said, "What is necessary to be said is the unity of the seminary. The unity of the seminary should be preserved. Let there be no name and hint of me." Martyred Ayatollah Mahallati, in this regard, said, "One day I took some money and I had taken as khums to the Imam Khomeini and gave it to him. The Imam advised me and said, 'Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi has passed away. Don't think that he was our sustainer, or Sheikh Abdul Karim Hayri Yazdi was our sustainer. Our sustainer is God Almighty. You should preserve the dignity of religious scholars and ulama so that people may not think that clerics are needy. Preserve the dignity of the religious scholars. You should not say the smallest phrase that implies the deficiency of religious scholars or ulama. You don't have the right to say anything to imply that you are forging a source of emulation, to say a word in my support or backbite another. You should do your duty properly to serve the people and the struggle." The late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, considered the unity and coherence of seminaries as very important. In this regard, Hujjatul Islam Ali Akbar Mas'udi says, "When Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi passed away, the Imam was very sad, but he didn't take part neither in the funeral procession nor in the mourning ceremonies for the Grand Ayatollah. When he was asked about the reason, he said, 'I think that perhaps my coming to the funeral and the memorial ceremony will divide the ranks of students. I don't want this division. I don't want this discrepancy. The great religious scholars of ulama should be in one rank too.'" Finally, Imam Khomeini held the ceremony to avoid the possible rumors that he was opposed to Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi. Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Murtazavi Langerudi mentions an anecdote in this regard. He says, "Imam Khomeini waited for all great religious scholars of ulama to hold memorial ceremonies for Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi and then he held such a ceremony himself. Dear listeners, as you see, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, attached priority to unity and solidarity of seminaries. Thus, when he realized that his refusal to hold the ceremony for Grand Ayatollah Bujedi might undermine the unity of the seminary, he accepted to do it. Yet, even in the ceremony, he became upset when the preacher mentioned his name as the cleric who had held the ceremony. Late Ayatollah Rizwani says in this regard, "When the Imam entered the ceremony, the preacher mentioned his name and said that the ceremony had been held on behalf of the Imam. Upon hearing his voice, the Imam summoned him and protested to him. He said, 'Till the end of this ceremony, you are not allowed to mention my name again.'"
The debate.
Going against warnings from fellow lawmakers and advisors, the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is to designate Yemen's Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist organization. The warning, this would exacerbate the humanitarian situation in the country, suffering from all kinds of diseases like malnutrition and famine. Now, in this edition of the debate, we will ask, what is this world coming to when the ones that are being bombed are being sanctioned, while the ones doing the bombing and the killing can go scot-free and get a green pass to continue the siege and the killing?
Saudi Arabia and its allies, backed by the United States, launched a devastating war against Yemen in March 2015 to oust the Ansarullah movement, which took power following the resignation of the country's former president, Abdul Rabbu Mansour Hadi. The conflict that has so far killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly women and children, has been described by the United Nations as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Nonetheless, in defiance of calls to help end the war, the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has decided to blacklist the Ansarullah movement. His Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, said the designation will take place on January 19th, the day before President-elect Joe Biden takes office. In a statement, Pompeo accused the movement of terrorist acts, destabilizing the region and obstructing a peaceful solution to the conflict in Yemen. The allegations drew backlash from Yemeni officials.
"Taking this decision at this time is the result of great local and international political pressure to stop the war in Yemen. And America is the one that does not want to stop this war and this aggression."
Yemen's Supreme Political Council also branded the United States as a source of terrorism and vowed to respond to its designation move. Iran also condemned the U.S. for branding Ansarullah a terrorist entity.
"It's likely the bankrupt U.S. government will do further damage to its reputation in its final days and leave the region with an even more poisonous legacy."
Aid groups also blasted the U.S. blacklisting move, with Oxfam calling the decision a counterproductive and dangerous policy that will put innocent lives at risk. The United States, along with some other Western countries, are major suppliers of weapons to Saudi Arabia. The Trump administration has so far turned a deaf ear to calls from international rights groups and politicians inside the U.S. to halt arms sales to the kingdom. Now the ball is in the court of Joe Biden, who will officially take the helm at the White House on January 20th. It remains to be seen whether he will toe the line of his predecessor towards Yemen or change course.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, radio host and political commentator Eli Joseph James, joins us from Chicago. We also have journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, who joins us from Brussels. Gentlemen, welcome. Let me first start with you, Elijah Magnier, if I may. We're looking at this sanction that the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has announced against the Ansarullah movement. And it does consist of three of its leading leaders. Now, Mike Pompeo, months ago, was advised against not doing this, or the Trump administration, but yet it has chosen this time to do it. Why do you think that is? Why do you think this day was the day that it or this time is the time that the announcement was made?
Well, the architect of the Saudi war in Yemen is definitely Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who has failed to develop a comprehensive strategy because he has no military experience or training. He lacks government management and a necessary intelligence to acknowledge that this is a useless war and far from being considered as a victory. He rather engaged in multiple human rights violations and crimes against humanity and gave an incentive for the Houthi to develop their deterrence. Now, it is the U.S. State Department who is responsible for the designation of foreign terrorist organizations. So the Crown Prince pushed Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in his last 8 days, and Pompeo, who visited Riyadh in the last few months, he pushed him to issue a designation against the Houthi, who never attacked Americans, but fought against Al-Qaeda and against the invaders of their countries. And here we're talking about Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. A foreign terrorist organization designation is definitely a political act. So the Trump administration could have made the technical decision to designate the Houthi any time in the last 4 years during the Trump administration. Now, under Biden administration, removing the designation is not that easy. It's a difficult political and bureaucratic process. Now, branding the Houthis as terrorists would be an attempt to block Biden and the world from speaking to the Houthi. The reality is the Houthi control most of northern Yemen, and it's better to hold direct talk with them than to live in a denial and ignore their control and presence in Yemen. Now, having direct contact with the Houthi will establish dialogue, direct talk, exchange of prisoners, halt the attacks on both sides, bring to Sana'a humanitarian support. The Saudis are desperate because the new Biden administration said it will block arms delivery to the kingdom and hold Crown Prince accountable for the Yemen war and all the murders that he did, and in particularly the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi 2 years ago in Istanbul. Even if the new administration doesn't hold Mohammed bin Salman to account, it is likely that there will be a cooperation in the Congress. So designing the Houthis as a foreign terrorist organization, it is definitely going to make it extremely difficult, that already difficult situation on the ground. It will neutralize the effort of humanitarian release organization to get food and medicine to millions of Yemenis.
Let's continue that trend of thought, Eli Joseph James. And ask you, given the fact that the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, was advised from months ago, and as our guest there from years ago, perhaps, if they wanted to designate the group as a terrorist organization, they may have been told this, that, you know, they're going to have a situation humanitarian-wise that's going to get exacerbated. After all, this is the world's largest humanitarian crisis. But given that fact and knowledge that the Secretary of State did have, he still went ahead. Or the Trump administration still went ahead with this. Do you think that? Why do you think that is? Why would they do this?
Well, let me say first that President Trump has actually been a relative peacemaker while he's been president. The Democratic Party, with Obama, you know, escalated the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, etc. It's Trump who's pulled out troops and has not made any new wars, which has been unusual for American presidents to not engage us in any new wars. However, given the fact that Biden and Hillary Clinton are cut from the same cloth, I would not expect any promises by Biden to be kept on behalf of Yemen and Houthi, none whatsoever. That's just propaganda he's issuing because he wants to curry favor with anybody who doesn't like Donald Trump, okay? Remember, it was Hillary Clinton who orchestrated the assassination of Gaddafi in Libya, and Biden has always been a supporter of Hillary Clinton, so I would not expect 1 ounce of support from Biden except rhetoric. That's all I would expect from Biden. As to why Mike Pompeo has done this. Again, I think it's just posturing by people. I don't think Trump wants to get us involved in yet another conflict. And from my perspective, America has pretty much stayed out of this, except for rattling sabers on behalf of Saudi Arabia and the Israelis. But this, from my perspective, this is Saudi Arabia's war against Yemen. So the Saudis need to be held accountable for invading a sovereign country. I don't know why they did it, but probably at the behest of the Israelis, whose basic policies in the Middle East is to disrupt every other nation except Israel. That's their basic policy. And because the Zionists have so much power here in America, whatever administration we have is pretty much going to do their will.
Okay.
The conclusion,
Elijah Magnier, that I'm getting from our guest there, Elijah Joseph James, is that the U.S. under President Donald Trump did not engage in a war during his 4 years, and Israel is the one that is interfering or that is somewhat having a hand in all the countries in West Asia, as we call it, or the Middle East. My question would be then, does the U.S. subscribe to provide military equipment via arms sales to countries like Saudi Arabia? Does that make it exempt from not participating in a war like in this case, Yemen, in which, by some accounts, hundreds of thousands have died?
I tend to agree with the half of the answer. So, yes, Israel acted as an advisor to Trump in giving it the Syrian Golan Heights, the occupied Syrian Golan Heights, Jerusalem, and Pompeo gave the settlement to Israel. But I fully disagree with your guest when saying Trump did not start a war. Indeed, he has started many wars, because war is not only military, it's also about sanctions. And he starved people in Venezuela, he starved people in Iran, in Syria, in Lebanon. So that is another soft war that is more harmful than a military war. And we saw the war on Iraq, how the Americans defeated Saddam Hussein, but then they couldn't win the war. So they found another way to allow ISIS to occupy the country. So no, Trump also killed General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi Mohandes. So yes, he made assassinations, and he pushed the whole Middle East to the verge of a very general war that he could start it but not end. On the other hand, in relation to Yemen, the U.S. sold weapons to Saudi Arabia to continue the war on Yemen, and that is a very direct participation to the war crime that the Saudis are committing with U.S. weapons and German and French and the U.K. So there are many participants to this war on Yemen, not directly with many troops on the ground, but there are definitely some U.S. troops guiding the Saudis and offering intelligence, and that is a war that have participated. So it is not right to say the U.S. is not participating to the war on Yemen. It is directly participating to the war, and Trump is responsible for the starvation that's a soft war on many other countries in the Middle East.
Well, Joseph James, I mean, we can't just skim over. I mean, when I asked you the question, you immediately went and talked about how under Obama, so forth and so on, and Biden is a supporter of Clinton. My question to you was about the humanitarian aspect. We can't skip over this. We're looking at the world's worst humanitarian crisis. This move puts humanitarian access at risk. There are people who are not only dying from now COVID-19, they're dying of starvation, famine, all different sorts of diseases. At the same time, what our guest there from Brussels said, it risks future peace talks between the Ansarullah and the opposition. Does the U.S. then want to sabotage, perhaps, any chance of peace by making this type of announcement?
Well, first let me say I can't argue with anything that Elijah just said in terms of boycotts, because, yes, indeed, boycotts are a form of war, right? I was just referring to a military invasion. But, yes, the United States government has been in bed with the Israelis since the Well, actually, since the Six-Day War, and in fact, the Israelis attacked one of our ships, the USS Liberty, and that's been downplayed and even totally suppressed. You know, so the Israelis make war on everybody. They make war on everybody. But it's Rothschild banks that run the show in virtually every country in the world, except possibly Iran. I'm not sure if there's any other country that has been resisting the will of the Israeli state and the Zionists who control the world economy. They control the world economy. So if any American president or leader contradicts the will of these Zionists, he's the first one going to be assassinated, as President Kennedy found out. So you can't blame this on the Americans. You have to look at the source. But I think in spite of all that, Trump has been a less aggressive president than anybody else. What I'm trying to say to you and Elijah is expect Biden to be far worse than Trump.
So this leaves us now in a situation where, as you said, Elijah, the Biden administration, I mean, this thing is going to go into effect possibly the 19th of January, a day before President-elect Biden's inauguration. So it's going to leave, kind of pass on the baton to him. What type of approach may we expect from Biden? Will he be proactive, as the news now indicates, for example, today, where key U.S. lawmakers actually urged a quick reversal of this? And I'm going to quote, "The designation of the Ansarullah as a terrorist organization is a death sentence for thousands of Yemenis," coming from Senator Chris Murphy.
Unfortunately, we can no longer trust what the president or president-elect or president candidates are saying. We saw what Obama said before the election, and we saw what Trump said before the election, and now we hear what Biden is saying prior to the election. So there are many talks today within the U.S. administration and many talks of the presidential candidates that they change their mind once they are in power. And we see Biden may have priorities like China, like Russia, like the nuclear deal with Iran, and perhaps Yemen is not on top of his list, as well as the withdrawing from Iraq or from Syria, or leaving Lebanon alone to sort out its own problem. So basically, we can't really trust what Biden is going to do, and we don't have to give a lot of weight to what he said against the Saudis and that he's going to stop the war in Yemen. Definitely, we can come out with the conclusion that Pompeo is doing everything he can to put pressure and to slow down any process the new Biden administration may have things to do in the future to remove all these sanctions, because, I mean, the guy is not stopping. Every single day in the last 20 days, he's coming out with the new sanctions. So what Biden is going to do is really unclear, and how much time he needs to undo all these obstacles that the Pompeo is putting in front of him, or perhaps benefit from these already imposed sanctions and are in place to say, hey, I didn't do it, that's Trump, and I need time to undo everything. So personally speaking, I cannot trust the Biden administration and say this guy is going to come and make changes. He had the domestic first, he had the relationship with the allies that are spoiled, and then he has China, Russia, etc. So no, I don't think the war on Yemen, the criminal and devastating war on Yemen, is going to stop in one day or in one month even.
Well, let's try to figure out, Eli Joseph James, what this war is all about. I mean, maybe you can tell us. Do you know what this war is all about?
Well, yes. I'm not sure. All I know is that the Saudis invaded Yemen, right? Not the other way around. And as you said at the very beginning, it's the victims who are being blamed for the crisis, when the crisis, when the big bully in the Middle East there is Saudi Arabia. They're the big bully. And as I have stated many times here at Press TV, the Saudis are puppets of the Israelis, and they do the will of the Israelis without question. So, and they're using the Saudis to destabilize the rest of the countries in the Middle East. That's what they're doing, especially Iran. We know what they did to Iraq, but they pitted Iraq against Iran in a war and elevated Saddam Hussein. Then they stabbed him in the back and made war against him. So this is the only kind of activity you can expect. And unfortunately, our government is so weak vis-a-vis the Zionist power. And of course, from the UN, because the UN is just another paper tiger in terms of how they approach these issues. Yeah, okay, so they may condemn the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, but what are they going to do? They're not going to do anything because the Rothschilds created the UN, the Rothschilds created the Israeli state, and really what needs to happen is the other Middle East countries, when there used to be an oil cartel, or we called an oil cartel, of people against the Rothschild money power, they need to reorganize against that same power and put pressure on them somehow. I don't think that they can organize a war against Iran, although they've been threatening that for the longest time. But the other Arab country, Arab and other countries in the Middle East need to join against this power called the Israeli state. None of this is going to stop until we do that.
Okay, my final question then goes to you. In Brussels, Elijah Magnier, there are some who have said that if this war was to stop, it could be done with one phone call from the U.S. to Saudi Arabia. Do you think that that is the case, that the U.S. could actually stop this war with one phone call to Saudi Arabia?
I think so, yes, because the Trump revealed many realities during his administration. He said to the Saudis, you would not last for 1 week without my protection. And he said, if you stay for 2 weeks, you will start speaking Farsi. Therefore, when the Americans put pressure on the Saudis to reconcile with Qatar, that was done from one day to another. And Saudi Arabia is just a kingdom that is imposing itself on the Saudis population because it had the Americans behind it, supporting it. And the Americans, obviously what Trump said, because he said many truths, he doesn't want to lose them. He doesn't want to lose their money. So the day the Americans decide to stop this war, I don't think it will require more than 24 hours. But the Americans are benefiting from this war as long as it lasts and continues. So are the Europeans. So there are many people benefiting from the misery of the Yemeni and the famine that they are going through and the killing of over 45,000 Yemeni in the useless 6 years of war just because Yemen and Sana'a decided in 2015 that there will be direct flight between Sana'a and Tehran and that the Iranians have access to the port of Hodeidah. That's it. The Yemenis are not allowed to have relationship with Iran and decide their fate, and they have to remain as servants to the backyard of the Saudis.
Okay, we're going to end with that. Thank you very much. Let me thank our guests, radio host and political commentator, Ellie Joseph James from Chicago, and journalist and political analyst, Elijah Magnier. Thank you. Spoke to us from Brussels. That does it for this edition of The Debate. For me, Kaveh Taqwa, and the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother, I'm Muhammad. And today, I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balawa. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام اتق الله بعض التقى وإن قل واجعل بينك وبين الله سترا وإن رق
أمير